typically in a colloquium series, when we hear about theoretical physics, we try to get people in to tell us about the latest, most interesting results. And sometimes we ask people from other fields to come in and tell us about the latest, most interesting results in our field. And that's the case this week. So our guest is Juan Bennett. He's going to tell us about what's new and interesting in web technology. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about his background. So Juan studied computer science at Stanford. Then he became an entrepreneur. And worked on various projects. Let me just mention a couple of projects that he's best known for. So he worked on something called the Interplanetary File System, IPFS. So this is a decentralized peer-to-peer web protocol that allows you to distribute data and applications without having to rely on a centralized server. The other project is something called Filecoin, which is a system for providing incentives for decentralized file storage. So a bit like Bitcoin, but rather than having users do computational work, they're offering file storage. Juan is the founder and CEO of Protocol Labs, which works on these projects and other projects. As such, he's an extremely busy guy, but he very kindly offered to take time out of his busy schedule to come here today and tell us about all the exciting new developments in web technologies. And let me just mention, he also is going to agree to be part of an informal discussion this evening, so it's part of the 3.14 series, which happens in the second floor bistro. So the discussion starts at 7 p.m., but you're also welcome to join for dinner, which starts at 5:30. And if you do want to join for dinner, then just email Dan Lynch, the bistro manager, to let him know your code. So with that, I'll turn it over to Juan.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for that very kind introduction. So today's talk is going to have these parts. So I'll mention a few things in rapid fire here in the open, just to kind of set some context. Then I'll try to set perspective a bit in terms of why this Web3 stuff matters at all, and also set perspective in computing and why computing right now is at a very interesting moment. Then I'll dive into what Web3 actually is, how is it different from Web 2 and Web 1. I'll talk about the actual technologies behind it. And then I'll dive into specific examples, very concrete examples of the technologies that that make all of this possible. So we'll actually get into some of the cryptography that makes these systems actually work. And we'll talk about the decentralized web, and we'll talk about blockchains. And within blockchains, there's probably a whole range of topics pulls in. Really, the word blockchain has now come to encompass a much larger set of topics than originally, than the very concrete thing it means. And so all kinds of things like game theory and equilibrium design and mechanism design for large-scale human systems is now getting lumped into that that term, which is why Web3 in the first place is an interesting thing. So we'll cover that. And then I have a number of, I can dive into a number of different kind of technical components as it seems interesting to the room. So I'll kind of be reading the room to get a sense of what kind of things kind of are raising eyebrows versus putting you to sleep. And then I'll kind of tune for that. So in terms of opening, I want to quickly flag some important things or very useful things that I think will be relevant to this audience. Number one is Melody Sheep. This is a science-oriented artist that has been making amazing videos that promote science in a whole bunch of ways, primarily physics, actually. So if you are interested in if you're interested in physics, you're here. If you're interested in art and how that works with science, check out Melody Sheep's amazing work. You might have seen Symphony of Science or heard some of that music. Auto-tune Carl Sagan, if you've ever seen that. No, nobody here. It's amazing. You'll get a kick out of it. I will flag two things here. Time-lapse of the entire universe is a 15-minute time-lapse of from the Big Bang to now. Just kind of assuming a lot of things, of course, but gives you a sense of kind of the formation of the universe. And then Timeless of the Future is an amazing piece of work that tries to actually play the clock forwards, and the time passing in the video goes up exponentially, and it goes into like the trillion years timescale. And so, of course, all of that is all kinds of different theories, different perspectives of what might or might not happen. But it is a very, very useful rendering of theories that many of you have spent a lot of time thinking about. And so I think it's a good example of something you can send to a much broader audience to put into everyday perspective, like the implications of what you're working on. The other thing I'll mention is Spacetime, which is also a YouTube channel that has a whole bunch of very interesting physics explainers. And it goes through things like relativity, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, all kinds of things in great detail. And so I think you can think of it as kind of introductory material, but it's probably much better than the majority of explainers that have been out there before. So again, useful to kind of convey useful material to people that are not in physics. As was mentioned, later today, we'll have this discussion around the future of the internet. I'll talk a little bit of that about, I'll set the stage a little bit for that today when we talk about perspective. And I also want to mention kind of what Protocol Labs is and why, beyond kind of the Web3 work that we're doing, why you'll see me mention a bunch of other things that are not quite related to that, but that we're working on. So I started PL2 because we're at this very moment in computing history where humanity has gone from a pre-computing, or very important moment in human history where humanity has gone from a pre-computing civilization to a post-computing civilization. And that is bringing all kinds of change decade over decade. And right now, the kind of work that's happening, there's a bunch of different strands, but one of the important pieces of work that's happening is around how we distribute information and how do we compute together, and what are the rules and rights that we have around information and systems. And so PL in general will do lots of things related to computing. And so right now we're very focused on Web3, but in the long term we are working on a number of different projects, some of them that are branching out from Web3, and we seek to build an institution. Protocol Labs is sort of a company, it's like this weird hybrid, it's kind of like a research startup company thing that is very open source. What we're trying to do is vertically integrate process of like pushing forward computer science from the theory space all the way to practice, to actually implementing things and shipping them to the real world, and treating every single point in that pipeline as a very important output that needs to be well integrated to the rest of the world, and all of that being open source. So that's a lot more to say about that, but this is what you'll hear me mention, a number of different kinds of things. Probably worth mentioning, a lot of the work we do is just entirely through GitHub, so it's a very different way of operating and doing research. I think the physics community pioneered things like archive and so on, and like pushed all of science forward in that direction, all kinds of other things, of course, in the past. But if you haven't never worked with other people on work through something like GitHub, I encourage you to try it out. It's a very interesting kind of environment where you're thinking out loud and you have your notebook publicly, and then suddenly people show up out of the woodwork and start working on that stuff with you, and you have a very different kind of collaborative landscape. We write up open problems as we find them, and we post them publicly. We try to structure the problems as carefully as we can so that other people can find solutions as quickly as possible. We're mostly interested in getting to the solutions faster, not necessarily we're not really interested in credit. We're also playing around, or not playing around, but we're dabbling and getting into actually funding other groups to drive some of this work forward. A lot of this is in kind of theoretical cryptography and theoretical distributed systems work, but later on we'll do other kinds of things. So there's kind of an RFP process that we're building. Great. All right, let's set some perspective. I like to think of things in ways that are kind of unusual for the common day to day. And so I think most people that you'll talk to on a day to day basis have a very small kind of like sliding window of their kind of perspective about history. And they'll kind of think about kind of the current year and maybe what might come in the next few years and what has happened over the last decade. Maybe the older people around you will think of kind of like the few decades timescale. But few people will try to consciously reflect on the large scale process that we're part of. And so, you know, short of like playing that whole like 15 minute video of like beginning of the universe up to now, which, you know, I would if we had a lot more time, at least just for humanity, it's useful to kind of look at what's been happening in the short term past. You know, things from the invention of like primitive technologies to the invention of more sophisticated forms of language and formation of groups, to writing and the formations of civilizations, to you know, better forms of distributing writing, so things like the printing press and economies and so on, to then suddenly the scientific revolution and this now explosive growth that we've managed to grab onto. You know, since then, in a very short time period, we've hooked into an advancement process that is would be baffling to anybody kind of like in those older timescales. And so when you do the reverse and you try to like project to the future, this gets really crazy, right? So like you start thinking about, okay, well, like in the next 10 years, we're already talking about things like virtual reality and augmented reality and all kinds of automation. And hey, like maybe we'll go back to space or you know, get to other planets and so on. You start thinking about biological augmentation and then all kinds of research that's going into actual, you know, yeah, not just kind of prosthetic limbs, but getting into people are starting to experiment with things like CRISPR and so on, which opens the door to all kinds of different things. And then, you know, we're also dealing with all kinds of changes in or promising paths in terms of nanotech and in terms of machine learning and AI and so on. And so the next 100 years are going to be the kind of technologies that are going to develop over the next 100 years are pretty beyond breathtaking. They're much more likely to impact humanity in a transformative way than the last 100 years. And I know that's crazy to think about because the last 100 years have been amazingly transformative for humanity. So just think of the next 100 years being even more so. And so we in this room get to live through some of the most exciting times in history for humanity ever, or beyond history, in kind of like the cosmic history. And of course, if you know, keep going, like what's going to happen? I guess like predictive power just goes away completely, especially with things like AI events. Like, what are we going to get to become a planetary or interstellar civilization or not? Are we going to like eventually make von Neumann probes? Like, what's gonna happen? Like all of what we know just kind of fades out. And so this just gives you a sense of, you know, in the past, people might have been able to predict what happened on like a 1,000 year or 10,000 year timescale just because things didn't change that much. But now we've hooked onto an amazingly fast process of change that really defies all kinds of explanation. And yet most of humanity feels that nothing changes, or most of humanity feels kind of stuck in like the day-to-day and kind of every year. And so it's a very different, trying to understand the kinds of changes that are happening and trying to then think of what levers can you pull to make sure that you end up in like good futures is both really important and really hard and very unusual. So I highly encourage you to do that. And I think one of the most important things that's happening across humanity is computing. And so, you know, it perhaps helps to think about it like this. So I recently have been thinking about it in terms of like the impact of the invention. So, you know, the Gutenberg press is seen as a very transformative invention for humanity, really kind of a watershed moment. But hey, so was writing, and writing was kind of like an order of magnitude or a few orders of magnitude more impactful than that. And then beyond that, there was language, and that was even a more impactful level of invention. And so, you know, is computing, you know, Gutenberg press type thing, or a writing type thing, or a language type thing? Or actually, is computing kind of like a life type thing, right? So the invention by the universe of life is an order beyond that. And I really think that computing is either a life type or a language type of invention. And so what we're seeing is that we're in, you know, 80 years in into an extremely transformative process that's much more related to the universe and physics than it is related to humans. In a sense that the kind of thing that you can get out of computing is kind of like a process of natural evolution that civilizations might go into. So beyond, you know, just look at what's happened over the last 80 years of, you know, short-term computing changes. We've gone from theorizing about these machines, building room-sized contraptions that made some calculations faster, to then wiring up the entire planet, to now all of us carrying around massive, what in the past would have been regarded as massive supercomputers. And we, you know, mostly use them to move around pictures of cats, but for the most part, these things are effectively magic to anybody 1,000 years ago, or even potentially 200 years ago. So you individually are one of the most powerful human beings to have ever lived, and what you can do individually transcends what many people, what all of our ancestors could do. And so now, armed with that power, you know, use it wisely. Try to aim for good futures, and know that in the next decades, computing is going to go through next generation improvements, and it's going to dive into deeper and deeper things. So, of course, augmented reality and virtual reality are kind of around the corner perpetually for the last decade or so. It might take another 10 years, might take 20. We'll see. Things like brain-machine interfaces are also kind of close. It's unclear. You know, these kinds of things are very hard to predict, but this could happen relatively soon. And then beyond that, we have things like automation, and you know, the automation of cars and here I mean like AI automation. So the automation of cars was kind of seen as extremely far off maybe 10 years ago, and now it, you know, raise your hand if you've like driven in a, or if you've been driven by an autonomous car. Really? Nobody? Nobody around here? Yeah. Okay. So maybe I'm the only person. So in the Bay Area, I get around like half hands raised. So an extremely exciting moment. This will happen relatively quickly. Along with this, though, there are other improvements that are much more important and deeper than that. So for example, the robotics changes that we've seen. Robotics is one of those things that has been much hyped for close to a century. Now, and a lot of things have, a lot of good results have happened, but we don't yet have Rosie the robot, right? But we're getting closer, and if you look at the, it's very interesting to see like the improvement that Boston Dynamics and groups like that can show. And so there are like great videos that you can go check out of like where robotics are today. Also, I think one of the most important things that happened recently in computing is that AlphaStar beat the game of StarCraft. So this is a result where, so StarCraft is a game, it's a strategy game where players control a sort of an economy and an army and kind of fight each other. So think of it like a you know, modern video game style version of chess, but it's extremely complicated and it's a much harder game than chess. And deep learning now, DeepMind effectively beat all of the champion, or deep beat the two very important champions in the game of StarCraft last year. And so this is an amazing achievement. I think it went very under-reported. And the thing that I think is much more important about this than, say, beating chess or beating Go is that something like StarCraft maps much more closely to real-life tasks that you might encounter. So think of traffic control or communication networks or optimization of swarms of robots and so on. And so all of that is now very possible. And so, of course, beyond that then looms like all the kind of questions about artificial intelligence. Will we get it? Will we not? Is that possible? I think sampling the world now, it's now kind of the experts agree, yeah, it's possible, and it's probably coming within 20 to 120 years. That's kind of like the expert opinion. If you were to poll those same people 20 years ago, people would have said 500 years. And so there's a big discrepancy there, and it's kind of it reminds me a little bit of kind of the era in physics where, you know, before relativity, People kind of felt physics was solved, and then relativity came in, and then quantum mechanics, and very quickly the world changed drastically. So artificial intelligence feels like one of those moments. It's unclear. We could be, you know, encountering all kinds of winters in the future. So hopefully, through this, I've given you the sense that computing not only is very important, but is very timely, and that over the next generations, over the next few years and decades, we are going to see massive changes in our society because of the things that are happening in computing right now. Hence, we're trying to hopefully aim for better outcomes. All right, so now with that perspective, I want to talk about why Web3 is a, first of all, what it is, and why it matters in this kind of computing landscape. So you can think of the progression of the internet as first achieving the physical task of wiring up everyone together, or all of our computers together. And then beyond that, building software systems to distribute content and programs. So Web 1.0 was primarily just data, moving around static data that you could read. So you can think of the original HTTP protocol and browser invented by the physics community, I might add, as a kind of a distributed system for moving around static content. The Web 2.0 world, and this is sort of began in the early 2000s, although you could see some of the beginnings of that even earlier, made that interactive. So we went from a read-only world to a read-write world. And then you saw the creation of all kinds of applications that brought interactivity and social components into these applications. Raise your hand if you've never used a Web 2.0 application. Like, no one in this room, right? Raise your hand if probably 50% of your work goes through one of these services today. Yeah, most people, right? Or about half. Now think about how all of that data and information that you put in these services goes somewhere in the magical cloud and is stored by someone who you're probably paying some of them, but probably not all of them. And you're kind of trading your attention for continued service. And you've probably encountered cases where those services disappeared, right? So raise your hand if you've used a web service that sent you a notice at some point and said, hey, you have 30 days to get your data out because we're shutting down. How did that feel? Did that suck? Yeah, right? So there's a problem here in the transition from Web 1.0 to Web 2.0. Web 1.0 had a strong feel of shared community and shared and the actual sharing of information with each other for the benefit of creating an integrated, decentralized and integrated knowledge base. And the Web 2.0 world took that and instead created a world of services where companies try to find good business models and found an amazingly lucrative business model in advertising, and then set up a business model where they could trade your attention for advertising, and then would provide you very useful, valuable services, which, when you think about it, are amazing superpowers that we were all granted effectively for free. When you think about Google Maps and how valuable that is to your daily life, and the fact that you don't really pay for it in the traditional sense. And so we acquired all these superpowers, but we then lost control of that data. And not only did we lose control of the data, but we also lost control and certainty that service would continue to exist in the future. So again, some things disappear. Of course, things that are really useful will remain. But there's a sort of problem here when you think about the superpowers that you have been granted suddenly being taken away. And certainly, the ones that shut down maybe don't feel as important. But what would happen tomorrow if your email just disappeared, or your Dropbox or Drive or whatever just disappeared completely and took all of the notes away with it? Right? That suddenly feels concerning. Feels pretty different. And so what Web 3.0 is about is to create systems and services that we can trust. And so it's going from a read-write model that is mostly based on services that other people control to a model where we bake in verifiability into the actual systems that we're building. So ideally, when you interact with a service, you should have a way to verify that it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. And you should have some way of establishing guarantees in the quality of service there, especially guarantees about what's going to happen when whoever's running the service decides that this is no longer relevant for them. So Web 3.0 right now is, I would guess, or I would put it sort of in the middle of the Web 1.0 world in terms of its development, in that Web 1.0 was effectively a toy and extremely hard to use for a lot of people. If you go back and consider how hard it was to actually get online and use a web browser and look at pages and so on, say in like 94, 95, that's kind of where Web 3.0 is. A lot of the stuff here is primarily useful and valuable to developers. It is not yet, a lot of it is not yet ready for broad adoption, but we're getting there and we're quite close. So I think probably within maybe a year or 2 years before like the main large-scale consumer applications get developed. I think right now, the whole web ecosystem, I think like the high watermark is that the most widely used services are in the millions. So millions of people using a particular system. And so that's, you know, to put in perspective, millions is much smaller than the Web 2.0 world, where people were able to get billions of people online, sometimes really quickly. So things like Instagram exploded and very quickly achieved tens to hundreds of millions of users. Whereas these systems have been built much slower, it's much harder to build, and their adoption rate has been smaller. But the reasoning, or the reason why, though, is that these systems are, there's a lot of hard fundamentals work to do, and I'll kind of walk you through some of that. So Web 3.0 kind of breaks that apart into, I would guess, or I would like to say three different components: decentralized web technologies, blockchain technologies, and then linked data things. So kind of like walk through some quick examples here. So I think right now, when you think about all of this data that is hosted in services, ideally we could move things to the point where like you have a sovereign notion or a self-sovereign notion of controlling your data, and that you have a way of authenticating yourself that isn't dependent on some other service or party, and that could actually identify you as a digital individual. So again, it's about making things verifiable, so able to be checked, demonstrated to be true. In a sense, Web 3.0 is a moment in which software starts eating economics and makes it extremely easy to create markets. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. And it's also about software eating law. So this is a moment where suddenly we're able to express with few lines of code something that looks similar to contracts and enforce them with computers in such a way that we can all look at the contract at the beginning, read it, agree to it, and once we agree to it, the contract will execute on its own, and there's nothing you can do about it. Meaning, the contract better express what's going to happen in a series of steps. And so you can think of a monetary system as being built on a contract like this. So if you come up with a notion of a currency or something even like a shared ownership of something, you can represent that in a contract, express it as code, put it into one of these systems, and then compute with it. Bitcoin is probably the most successful thing in this example. We'll talk a bit more about Ethereum. Just talking about verifiability. I'll dive more into all these examples in a moment. The other thing that is happening in Web3 is that we're creating open services. So this is the merger of open source with services. In the past, open source has primarily been about writing code and creating digital goods. Now we're creating things that resemble utilities. So think of a large group of people maintaining a service, not centrally controlled at all. Rather, it's a group of mutually distressing participants that are together running a service. And so that sounds kind of crazy. We'll look at how that happens. But this is extremely powerful because it means that we can create transnational or like global systems that provide a service to humanity where the organizing principle is an economic mechanism, not a centrally planned organization that has all kinds of failure modes like, hey, the organization ran out of money or fell apart or its leadership like decided to move in a different direction or whatever. The point here is that we're now creating systems that are becoming part of the internet that have service-like qualities, which is pretty different. And so examples of these services are things like, again, digital currencies, things like prediction markets, really all kinds of markets, but then also registries of information. So this means you can think of registries of names or numbers and identity and so on. And so think of potentially the kind of initial Facebook value proposition was that it was going to create your identity online. So you can think of a system where you actually own your identity and you own the information that gets associated with it, and that's not dependent on some other third-party company, and it's instead maintained, the information is maintained online by a utility. So I mentioned markets a couple times, and so what's going on is that we're making programmable markets now. So think of, for a moment, of something like Airbnb, where you have a supply and demand side on an asset that was previously not commoditized, where it was extremely difficult to enter the market because the market that existed before was one where you had to have all kinds of, you know, when you think about trying to rent a spare bedroom in pre-Airbnb days, imagine trying to compete with a hotel system and trying to advertise your room and advertise rates and trying to convince people this was going to be a good idea. It happened in the margin, but it is not what it is today. And what happened there was the creation of a market and understanding the dynamics of users transacting in this market and making that process smooth. The issue, though, is that in this particular market, though it was kind of created by software and scaled, it's not, again, it kind of depends on a particular organization. And the vast majority of the wealth created by this market ended up going to that organization. So instead of consider resource markets that are organized by software, where the participants are engaging on this kind of commoditizing of some previously hard to commoditize resource, but they're instead organized by software and are taking part of an economy and sharing in the appreciation of that economy. I'll dive into detail of what a system like this might look like and how you actually compose it. Great, so that's kind of like the high level of what Web3 is. And so hopefully I touched on a number of things. There's more to describe in terms of incentive structures and mechanism design and so on that we'll dive into in a moment. So let's talk about decentralized web for a moment. I really like using this diagram. This is one of the original diagrams of the packet switch networks. This is kind of pre-internet days. And it kind of categorized networks in terms of centralized, decentralized, and distributed. And the important point here is a centralized network is extremely easy to attack. It's one point of failure. What was here called the decentralized network was harder to attack, but still kind of had a dependence on particular nodes. And what was there described as a fully distributed network was an operation where any particular node, whether or not it was had higher resources or lower resources, would be able to function fully and distribute information to every other participant. So that's kind of what IPFS is for, or rather, that's exactly what IPFS is for the web. And so you can think of HTTP as the technology that makes the web 1.0 world work. And kind of the web 2.0 world was sort of bolted on top of that. But HTTP is the primary transport by which most of the applications you use today transmit information. And they have this really harsh centralization component where all of the content that you use gets addressed at a particular point location. What IPFS is and what the decentralized web push is doing is instead make the addressing not dependent on locations, which then makes the information be able to be broadly distributed. Concretely, you can think of a URL in HTTP as having mapping a string of characters where you have a domain name, and the domain name is kind of like a human readable name that you look up in some distributed system, and you map that to an IP address. An IP address is just, think of it as a phone number equivalent in the internet, and that IP address it means a particular location. So the point here is that whatever foobarbaz.png, which is some file, means to everybody on the planet is really just the particular file at that particular location. So imagine a world where there's a lot of computers in the world that have that exact same file, but it doesn't matter. What that file means is the exact one in that location. To drive this point very concretely, imagine if the only way we could communicate about books or papers was something like this. Hey, you should really read this amazing book. It's in the New York Public Library, in section 9, bookcase 3, top shelf, first from the left. I can't tell you the title, I can't tell you the author, I can't tell you the ISBN, nothing. You need to go there and physically grab the book to understand what I'm talking about. So that's the equivalent of what HTTP is today, and kind of seems crazy. But at the time, it was a very useful, efficient way of making progress, so it's natural that it happened that way. But we now have to unwind that and move a different direction. So the important point, though, is like right now, the information on the web is not like a physical book. A physical printed book can be handed to somebody, and that person now has control of that information, can copy it, can look at it, can read it. In the web, whenever you look at a page, you have to make a request. And at that moment in time, retrieve whatever is happening there and render it. If you get disconnected, too bad. Maybe you have like a cache copy, but it's kind of doesn't quite work. So the point here is to move from that model into a model where we're individually addressing all the information with cryptographic fingerprints. And what that means is that if you have that file, it really doesn't matter who has it or where it is or whatever. You should be able to retrieve it as efficiently as possible, wherever it is, and you should have a way of talking about that file independently of its location. So that's the, you know, it's at the core, it's just this important change moving from a location addressing world to a content addressing world that IPFS is doing. So again, this is kind of how this happens. So suddenly, now anybody can move around the content. The way that works is that we use a cryptographic hash to address the information and point from one thing to another. A cryptographic hash is a mathematical function that takes, you know, some you can think of like some message of arbitrary length and compresses it down to a fixed size with some additional properties. And so this is what distinguishes a cryptographic hash from a non-cryptographic hash. The important parts here are the hash has to be collision resistant, meaning that I shouldn't be able to come up with two files that hash to the same number. Of course, if you're mapping infinite or extremely large sequences down to a smaller size, that could happen. But you can choose a bit length that is large enough where you're pretty sure that that's not going to happen in kind of like a day-to-day environment, or you know, towards you know the what we expect to be the lifetime of the universe or something like that, which is usually pretty good security. The other thing that cryptographic hash functions need is that they need to be pre-image resistant. So given a hash function, you shouldn't be able to, or it should be hard for you to come up with what file maps to that hash function. It's an important security property. And the second property is that it's pre-image resistance, meaning that if you start with a file and start permuting a little bit, you shouldn't be able to over time kind of understand how to find something else that matches that. Because if you have second pre-image resistance, or if you don't have that, then you can create collisions, and that would be bad. So we use these hash functions, which you know are these really long numbers. Think of like you know 256 bits, to then independently address every file, and then we link the relationship between files and directories and so on using these hashes. So that means that a directory maps names to these hashes, and that way you can explore content. So that means that a website or the information on the web could be on your browser. And then somebody else next to you could be trying to pull the exact same information and then realize that the browser next to them has that information, connect to them, and retrieve that information from them. And this could happen even when your connectivity to the rest of the world is offline. So the point here is like, you know, imagine you're in this room, you're working together, and the connectivity to the rest of the world kind of shuts down or has a hiccup or something like that. And suddenly, all of your cloud work just halts because you can't interact with the person next to you because right now, all of that work is mediated by some computer somewhere that you don't know anything about. The point here is to make that operate in a distributed setting. What does that look like? You can play around with it. Right now, it's in wide deployment now. Again, like I mentioned, it's in kind of the single million end users, single to 10 million end user range. A whole bunch of websites are using it. And what this gives you, what this hash function addressing gives you, is that it makes it easy. It changes kind of the efficiency dynamics. It makes it more secure. And it makes it censorship resistant. So I'll give you an example in a moment of kind of how it's been used that way. The other thing it makes possible is it makes dynamic applications that are operating with each other in the same room without, again, having to go to the rest of the world. So think of if you've been on a train or a plane and try to edit a Google Doc, and you're frustrated that you can't interact with like the person right next to you, sitting next to you, and you can't use your amazing supercomputer to move a little bit of a few bits from this screen to this screen, right? Like, that's a very stupid problem that should not exist anymore. The other thing that this enables is the archiving and distributing of really valuable, important data. So there's a whole bunch of efforts around shared distribution and caching and backing up of really, really valuable data sets. So there was some effort around, the last couple of years, some things happened in the US government, and they were defunding some agencies, and so people scrambled to save extremely valuable climate data sets that were potentially going to get defunded and back them up in systems like this. The other thing that suddenly becomes possible is that if your government decides one day to shut off Wikipedia because Wikipedia has images that the president doesn't like, and you know they decided to get rid of this very important social resource because, hey, screw them, right? Then suddenly what you can do is put all of Wikipedia into a system like this, and then it becomes fully distributed, and you can't block it that way anymore. So that's a very important property that you get out of systems like this. This was very surprising to us. In the referendum that happened in Catalonia, we woke up that day to find out that the Spanish government was blocking the Catalan websites telling people where to go vote, and that the Catalan group started using IPFS to distribute the polling stations. And there was this tweet from the Catalan president tweeting out a link to IPFS, which was extremely impactful for us in terms of, hey, people are actually using these systems or these properties. And so this goes back to an important disintermediation thing around what Web3 is giving, which is putting data and information back in the control of the users as opposed to kind of in parties around them. IPFS is it's made by a large community of people. And the decentralized web movement is larger. It all relates to these kinds of concepts around making the web operate with these principles. It's a larger effort, and there's a lot of different groups pushing this forward. All right, let's dive into blockchains. So you've probably heard of things like Bitcoin and Ethereum. Yeah, raise your hand if you've heard about Bitcoin. All right, Ethereum. Yeah, great, good amount of people. So again, basic picture is something like this. We want to move from a traditional trust environment like that into an environment where things are verifiable by a network. And so I'm going to kind of break down what a blockchain is to give you a very concrete way of thinking about what it means, meaning let's just actually look at the data structures. So blockchain, I want you to just think about it as a sequence of transactions, which is an ordered sequence of transactions. And you know, these can be data, but of course they can also be programs because code is data. And you know, if you are into computer science, you can also see these transactions as messages and kind of function invocations, but I won't get into the meaning of that in a moment. And so this blockchain system is some ordered set of transactions where you can add a transaction and you can see what the transactions exist with some very important properties, which are that everyone in the system should be able to see the same set of transactions and agree on the sequence. And out of that, we can get some really useful systems built on top. So again, just where a blockchain is an ordered sequence of messages, which could be data or programs. And in practice, these get really large. So you can think of, you know, in the millions of messages, millions of transactions, and so on. The reason it's called a blockchain is because we just batch transactions into bundles, which we call blocks. So you can think of each block as just a group of transactions. And all of those are little programs. So what this means is that we enter a computational model where there's some growing sequence of transactions and programs somewhere in the world, in the network. And a computer, so i.e. your computer, can pull down all of the transactions and then run all those programs in its local state and then compute what the output of applying all of those transactions would look like. And so again, you know, you can think of the blocks. The blocks are kind of a distraction here. The important thing is that there are these sequences, these functions being applied to the same system. And the important thing here is that as it goes, you can compute whether or not that applied correctly. So you can think of a transaction as you know, potentially moving money or something like that, and you can check that that transaction can be applied correctly or not. So if you're trying to deduct money that doesn't exist, you can mark that as an invalid transaction. So you're like, how is this interesting? This is just like a database. Didn't we make this in like the 50s, 60s? Yes, we did. But the important thing here is that this is a distributed system that scales to the whole internet, where no party controls what the outcome of those transactions are, and no party gets to change the record of those transactions. So you can end where you get to also participate in the extension of this chain. So you can look at potential suggested transactions out of a pool, evaluate them, see which one is correct, and then extend it that way. And so this is just what a blockchain is. It's just a large-scale distributed system for agreement on the sequence of events that we are coming up with and applying all of the transactions in order. And so, of course, that sounds reasonable and kind of like a in an honest world, why would you need this? It sounds really expensive. Why are we having a huge network of computers around the world all doing this process when we can just trust a party? Where it gets interesting is where, hey, a malicious party could be doing this, and you can just go and check the work and make sure that it's correct. And if it's not, you can just discard whatever they're giving you and move and find the actual like correct sequence of events. And the reality is that the internet is a world where the vast majority of computers out there are not altruistic and honest. They're actually irrational. They will defect and from you and try to do something else if it's more advantageous. If it's more advantageous to them. So this is where economics and game theory come in. When you think of a system like Bitcoin or a system like Ethereum, there's a whole bunch of mechanisms built into the design of the system to make sure that it becomes rational to behave according to the protocol, so that when parties are evaluating this chain, the thing that maximizes their financial reward is to behave correctly according to the protocol. So there's a whole bunch of different properties here that blockchains give you that traditional databases gave you in a different way. So again, we mentioned agreement. So that's just everybody agreeing on the same outcome of events. Verifiability, which means that you as a participant in the system can go and check the correctness of the sequence of events, that your transaction that you put in has actually cleared correctly. And this transaction could be anything, right? It doesn't have to be money. It could be any kind of other system. It also gives you a notion of liveness that some people consider much stronger than traditional systems, meaning that whoever's running Bitcoin today, or Ethereum for that matter, could stop. And if you just have the chain, you can go and continue it yourself. You don't have to ask permission from anybody. You can just take the data and start running it separately. And that is a property that completely distinguishes these systems from the traditional databases. You can't just go walk up to Google or Twitter and ask them for a dump of their database and then set up a competing service with the exact same code and the exact same network and everything and have it work exactly the same the next day. But with Bitcoin and Ethereum, you can. And that's an extremely powerful primitive. And of course, security here means that the transactions are being applied correctly, that people can't bias the system. There's all kinds of components there that attackers may be able to exploit the system in various ways. And so you want, of course, you want all of that to be secure. This is kind of a catch-all for a lot of different kind of properties. Then there are a set of other properties that some blockchains give you and some don't, or where the community as a whole is trying to improve upon. So one of them is transparency. So in Bitcoin and Ethereum, these are transparent ledgers where all of the transactions that are being accumulated can be transparently read by everybody. So you can go and look at every single transaction that's happening. That's very different from the real world. You can't just go and audit all transactions in the economy of a country or the economy of a company. It's a different picture. Now, that goes against the last property that's listed there, which is privacy. There's a lot of cases where you don't want all the transactions to be expressed that way. You want to make sure that it's a correct transaction, but you don't necessarily want it to be fully transparent to the world. So there's also another notion around transparency, which is transparency with privacy, meaning I should be able to do something and affect a transaction and not show you what actually happened, but prove to you, so write a computational proof that shows that I did the work correctly. And so that's a different kind of transparency, where you know that all the behavior is applying correctly, but you don't get to see the actual data that's happening. And that's kind of a nice sweet spot for a lot of these systems where you don't necessarily want to hand everyone in the world your entire private data, but you do want to behave or operate in a system that can check correctness. Immutability is another property here, which is that the economy tomorrow should not be at a different point, a completely different point than yesterday. So tomorrow, your entire savings should not disappear. That's kind of like a useful property out of economies, and that's a really key distinguishing feature here as to why these blockchain systems can be used for economies, whereas normal databases are not that good. Meaning, you trust banks because they're heavily regulated entities, and they're regulated by the government, and so you have like a very large amount of trust in the whole government bank system, and that's what makes you okay trusting banks with money. But you wouldn't randomly trust some weird service in the web that just kind of promises to hold your life savings. And you wouldn't necessarily trust their currency, but these blockchain systems give you that immutability, give you the ability to have a system that is only accreting transactions and according to a verifiable set of principles. And so this, in countries where the rule of law is weaker, this is an extremely important property. So you're now talking about financial systems that are not under the control of groups that might be corrupt. So again, this is not that big of a deal in a lot of the liberal democracies, but this is a really, really big deal in a lot of countries in the world where they can't quite count on their banks or governments not to overnight change the rules of the game. So that kind of interacts with decentralization quite a bit. Open membership is an important property around being able to join these systems and be part of the computation. So I can take this laptop, download a piece of software, join the network, and start computing along with it. Censorship resistance, I already talked about, is the ability to maintain this system running even when large actors, potentially state actors, wanted to stop. And that's again, a big deal because something like an economy might need that kind of level of resistance. These other properties are kind of specific to kind of computer science issues around the actual behavior of the system. Synchrony assumptions are around the timing of events. Do you require the network to kind of advance at the same time, or can it start and stop on its own? Partition tolerance is the ability for a system to continue operating in light of a disconnection from the rest of the network. So imagine the North America partitions from the rest of the world, so it can't talk to Asia or Europe or anything like that. You would want these systems to continue operating in light of those partitions. That right now in the blockchain system is a shaky story. It sort of continues in that it will continue, but the two sides of the world will continue processing transactions, and when they merge, you then have to sort out whether you kind of rebase the transactions on top of the others. But these are very interesting areas of research, so this is where a lot of the active work right now is happening. Scalability is another one of these where these systems where everybody's broadcasting transactions and adding them to the same set of growing this blockchain that is accounting all the different transactions is quite slow and is limited by speed of light, right? Like you can only propagate transactions and blocks around the planet with certain kind of time delay and bandwidth limits. And so that imposes a very harsh scalability problem on these systems. And so probably the hottest area of research in this environment is how to make these things scale to being able to process billions or trillions of transactions per second, where right now we're in like the low, I think like the best systems are in the low thousands. So this is kind of how the whole blockchain world is doing on these properties and kind of what they mean. So I'll give you kind of a very concrete example of how something like this would work. So imagine that we want to create a coin on top of a blockchain, and this coin could be an economy that we can just run together, or we can run as part of like a nation or something like that. All we have to do is construct our transactions such that we can verify them. And as we apply all the transactions, then compute what the accounts balances are, right? So all we do is log the transactions, and anybody can come up with the actual balance. And so you just keep adding transactions. If you encounter something that can't happen, like for example, in this case, this transaction is trying to send 50 from one account that does not have that balance, then you just reject that and you move on to the next thing. That doesn't apply. Now, of course, you don't necessarily want to publish all of these things. You would want to have some privacy, but beyond that, you don't just want to allow anybody to add a transaction like this. So what these systems use is digital signatures, which is a way to associate the ability to make changes with a public and private key pair. So we change the account names into public keys. And so digital signatures are just a really, really nice cryptographic system where there are all different kinds of algorithms behind that give you public-private key pairs. So cryptography is an amazing field where you have these kind of like idealized constructions, these kind of like ideal mathematical functions that you want to operate, and you then construct a whole bunch of algorithms on top of these functions, and then you realize these mathematical functions with some algorithms, some very concrete instantiations of them that then might have some security properties that or efficiency properties that you want, and then you kind of trade off performance and security according to kind of like where you are in time, because as time goes on, computational power goes up, or hey, maybe we'll have quantum computers someday, and then a whole bunch of algorithms will break. But that's kind of how crypto kind of works. And what the way that digital signatures work is that we can come up with two keys, which are sets of numbers, and we can come up with a pair of algorithms that allow you to disseminate one of the numbers to the whole world, and that's kind of the public key pair, and withhold the private key pair. And then you can use a private key pair to sign something. So you run an algorithm with that number and whatever it is that you're signing and create a digital signature. And now anybody who has the public key can then verify that you correctly signed that. So this is how all security on the web works today. The actual algorithms are pretty nifty to think about, and that's something I'm happy to discuss with people offline. It's kind of like there are all kinds of like very interesting instantiations. And new ones come out here and there with like new primitives. So if you're interested in math and crypto, exploring different areas of math that enable you to suddenly do all the normal like digital signatures and all that kind of things happens every once in a while. So with that, effectively how we suddenly make our coin be authenticated so that only you can change it is all we have to do is add a signature to this transaction. So we make sure to sign that transaction with our private key, or secret key, SK is the abbreviation. And that means that anybody that verifies this can actually check that you indeed issued that transaction. Now this has a bug, which is that you could replay, meaning like I could take the exact same data of the transaction and the signature and take your transaction and issue it twice, and then cause that payment to happen two times. Then a fix for that then would add a specific number, so that you would change this. This is an example of how these systems are both easy, but error prone to build. So you can construct these kinds of like very interesting, sophisticated systems where now if we have a blockchain and we have just this transaction system, we can build an economy that where you have complete control, complete direct control using just some numbers that you have that only you know, to control money, which is when you think about the massive infrastructure that a banking system and a government system means, like that's an extremely powerful primitive. But hey, if somebody messed up the crypto, the whole thing could be broken, and like that's kind of like a rocket, in a sense where the stuff has to be like really, really right. I mean, that goes for all computing systems. So yes, even the normal banking systems you use, that's no different. And maybe a benefit here is that everybody gets to audit what's actually going on under the hood. So then what that suggests is that we can take the system and then turn it into a contract, where a contract here is just a program that's going to run on this blockchain thing. So we can come up with like a toy language here where we can kind of say, hey, we're going to create a contract for this coin thing. This coin thing is just going to keep a mapping of balances from like public keys to some integer. And it's just going to run one function where whenever you call that function, you give it a from, to, amount, and a signature. And then out of that can affect the change. And so you can go and write this program, deploy it into chain, and now you've created a little economy, which is an extremely powerful primitive. So that's why a lot of the blockchain systems are extremely interesting, which is, you know, this is a toy example with coins, but you can think of this as applying to all kinds of other legal and financial constructs and all kinds of other ways of interacting and transacting with other people. So again, I think right now it's highly focused on the blockchain ecosystem is highly focused on financial transactions because those are both highly valuable and not that hard to do. But as this goes on, this is seeping into much more complicated environments, including normal messaging systems and games and so on. And yeah, like we said before, this has that same bug, which is if you don't add an additional parameter here to track which version, then you could replay. This was called a replay attack. You could also create something like multiple signatures. Again, this is also very likely to be to have, this is kind of like the thing that I like, threw together in a couple minutes. But it gives you an idea of like how powerful these systems are, but also how they have to be right. So this is a kind of like multi-sig construction where we can suddenly construct a shared ownership of some asset, which is, again, this could be coins, this could be authorization on some system, this could be granting entrance to something, this could be a will, this could be all kinds of things. You can build a mechanism and install it into this blockchain that then suddenly starts operating. And so this is why it's called a smart contract. You write the contract, you deploy it into the network, and then now it can operate on its own. Great. So now we're like at the hour mark. I'm going to talk about a couple things, and then we'll open for questions. And then I have a whole bunch of other interesting sets of constructions that I'm happy to discuss with people that are like more interested in like the nitty-gritty of crypto systems. I'll mention, like, I talked a little bit about markets, which is, you can similarly think of constructing a contract that, and here the contract is much more complicated, where you create a system, like a market system, where you mediate the exchange between clients and providers of storage, where participants want to add bids for storage, and the providers want to provide their storage to the rest of the network. And you can create a market out of a system like this where you can aggregate all the bids and asks from both parties, kind of market make, match the orders, and then create a system where clients can effectively like lock up their money with this system and hand their data, their encrypted data, to some service providers. And then those service providers store their data and over time prove that they're continuing to store it correctly to get some of the reward over time. So this is how you can build something like a digital utility or like an open service for providing cloud storage in using blockchain primitives. And this is a crypto system where you agree to store something and then you prove over time that you're actually indeed storing it. And then kind of money gets released over time. And so this has to operate in an environment where anybody here could be malicious or just rational, right? Where parties, in order to try and gain a lot of money, will try to game it as much as possible. And so you have to have a system that is resistant to all those kinds of, a whole bunch of different kinds of attacks. And you can't even trust the clients. And so this is what kind of makes the design of these systems extremely interesting and complicated, which is that you have to have a proper equilibrium and attack resistance from all actors in the system. So you could have all kinds of collusions between the parties that are asking the system to store data and the parties that are agreeing to store data and so on. And so the system has to be robust to all these kinds of failures. But once you build something like that, then it's an extremely powerful primitive because it can continue, like Bitcoin, it can continue operating beyond kind of individual actors coming and going and so on. So you can think of a system like Falcon as organizing resource sharing similar to kind of Airbnb, with the added bonus that there's a component here which is a very interesting like equilibrium design question, which is you want to create an equilibrium for adding as much storage to the network as possible. And so that's how you can build a very large network. And so this is kind of what Bitcoin did with hash rate. I won't go into details now, just out of time, but it's an interesting component. The last thing I'll mention here is credit attribution, which is an interesting component that we're exploring in light of how these blockchain systems, in light of what these blockchain systems enable. So right now, we're in a moment in history where there's all kinds of human systems reliant on the correct attribution of credit, and yet our systems for credit attribution are actually quite broken. So what I mean by that, so in systems like academia or companies or whatever, people and parties and organizations do a whole bunch of work to produce something, and that thing is produced and has some impact, both negative or positive. And then credit kind of flows back through some distribution of credit attribution that may not actually match reality. So a good example of that is when I think probably everyone, scientists here, all kinds of papers get written with different kinds of work involved, or you have a whole bunch of citations. Sometimes you're refuting something, sometimes you're actually leaning very strongly on one paper and not another, but they all kind of look the same. In other environments, and also you have a system where, science has a system right now where people hoard important insights and results because you need to make sure that you publish the main results so that you can get the credit, so that you can then achieve a certain standing in the social academic environment, so that you can continue getting funding, so that you can continue doing work in the future. So this really broken incentive system where ideally we're trying to advance science as fast as possible and share all our insights and results as quickly as we have them and kind of have an open shared notebook in the world. But yet the incentive structure forces everybody to kind of hoard insights because that's the way that you ensure you and your group's continued ability to do the work. And so that's super broken. With potentially a better attribution model where you can understand the information that's going into the work, you can change what it looks like. So now in software, we're actually a lot closer to something like that because the majority of software gets written through systems where all the interactions are tracked. And you could, and not just the actual code contributions, but then all kinds of information going on GitHub, so GitHub issues and discussions and so on. It's not everything. Not everything gets tracked digitally, but a lot of it is, a lot more than what used to be talked about. So, and a project that we're working on is a system called SourceGrid, where we go through and evaluate all, try to ingest all of the contribution graph of a software system, including code and comments and all of that, and then use PageRank to try and understand the value of contributions, and then is highly tunable, where there's all kinds of parameters where project maintainers can tune what they want to reward. So if they want to reward things like better documentation or more closing of bugs or things like that, they can tweak the cred distribution for that time period and kind of reward more cred along the way. So this is an interesting experiment that we're pushing for, and there's a lot of other groups that are working on similar things. So it's an exciting moment for this kind of credit attribution world. And it gets more interesting when you start thinking about how that relates across projects. So you can think of not just credit attribution in terms of a whole bunch of humans working on a thing. You can think of credit attribution as a chaining in a large graph of operation and production across all kinds of important information goods, or all kinds of goods in general. And the reason this relates to Web3 is that once you have that whole graph, then it's extremely easy to then just pour actual financial assets as a reward through that entire graph of contribution. So you can think of a different financial model where you're not hiring people to work hourly on a knowledge work, which has nothing to do with or has some to do, but not that much to do with time. It's much more about the knowledge content of your mind. And you can couple that to a financial system as well, where you have a very different way of assigning and attributing credit and having the rewards actually flow through. So open source today has this huge set of issues around who actually does a lot of the work and whether or not they get funding, whereas a lot of the value capture that comes out of these open source systems gets captured by some corporation somewhere and doesn't really flow back to the people that are actually making the thing. And oftentimes there's great examples of Tragedy of the Commons behavior, where very, very critical infrastructure pieces don't get required funding and they break because nobody bothered to like make sure the developers were capable of working full time on the thing and so on. And so that's, you know, an attempt that suddenly we can fix with both better tooling around credit attribution and then sort of this crypto economic world where you can move financial assets through these kinds of systems. A whole other part of that is like, can you start engineering equilibria for projects where like instead of requiring individuals to drive the creation of a lot of these things, can you create equilibria and reward systems that just are kind of like milestone oriented and success oriented and create like actual metrics? And then that could potentially be a way of organizing human work at very different scales than what is possible today. So anyway, that's a lot of that's interesting. We have other stuff, but want to stop here because I think we're over an hour now. So thank you very much.
So you mentioned that in the Web 2.0, there's this very successful business model assigned to it. Do you have some kind of like high level description of what business model could drive the development of Web 3.0?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting result. And what's effectively happened is that with something like Bitcoin, which has a currency on its own right, if you're a holder of Bitcoin, if you go and like acquire Bitcoin by either mining it yourself or buying it, and I didn't go into it and explain like what Bitcoin mining means, but think of like participating in the network and helping to maintain this blockchain as rewarding you in units of the actual currency. And that's kind of what was instrumental for Bitcoin to actually get off the ground, in that it had a clever incentive structure for saying, hey, if you want to help maintain this blockchain, here's some money, right? Like that's kind of what I meant by creating these open services. You participate in the service, you help run it, and then you get some financial reward for doing so. So it creates a rational equilibrium it makes it much more likely that it's rational to correctly, because these things are not quite proved to be equilibriums, makes it much more likely that it's rational to behave according to the protocol. So development is not actually funded that way yet. There are some experiments. Something like SourceGrid could help there, right? Like you make certain kind of contributions, you create a lottery, like every week you distribute a certain amount of currency, and it gets proportionally distributed to like whoever's like accruing cred or something like that. You could do things like that. But the way that it worked in Bitcoin's case is that there were people that just had a lot of Bitcoin and then said, ooh, if I work on Bitcoin and make it better and then it appreciates, then that's kind of like getting paid. And so that has happened to a great degree in a lot of blockchain systems. Now that system is kind of running out of steam to some degree in some other environments. It's kind of hard to replicate because you need a pretty sustained appreciation rate that in a kind of a steady-state economy, like you might not see. This is where other ways of rewarding developers with actual units of the currency come in. And so that becomes like not advertising oriented, but it becomes like, you know, you're getting a stake in the system that you're actually building.
Then the resources would come from people who are using the system.
Yeah. So we're talking about is like build an economy where there's some token that maintains that economy. If you want to use the service, you have to buy the token, right? And so by the fact that you have to buy it, you're kind of appreciating it a little bit. And so you go and buy the token, you start spending it, and that token then gets spent and distributed to the people that are providing the service. Now, if you're a developer and you want to help construct it, so that's already right there a business model for the people providing the service, right? There's a whole bunch of properties that you need to have in that economy to make sure that the price is actually stable and so on, but you can do that. The other thing you mentioned is actually developers, like the actual like people that write the code for this stuff, don't quite figure in the rules of the system, and that's what's getting explored now.
So I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the difference between the distributed and the decentralized kind of networks, and which you find better? Because it seems like even in the decentralized one, you still have a notion of hierarchy.
And this is an interesting point of contention in the community, because I popularize this graph, and then like people are like, oh, but like it doesn't capture everything. So the as this is defined, you know, you would want to aim to fully distributed networks. The problem with that is that they're much harder to change. Meaning once you distribute software, it's very difficult to kind of get agreement between all parties to then like roll up to the next thing. And so, you know, I would strongly argue for like go to, you know, kind of what's fully distributed there. A lot of people in the decentralized community would kind of call that properly decentralized and would kind of disagree with this framing. I think it's extremely useful in distinguishing a system that is somewhat decentralized from one that is like, you know, fully.
From the way you were talking about the Web 3.0, it kind of reminds me the way Torrent works, kind of like a peer-to-peer file share system.
Yep.
And it was a great idea to have a torrent. I don't think the initial incentive to create a torrent was to share movies illegally. Do you think there's a legal constraint to universalizing Web 3.0? Kind of like, how do you enforce?
Yeah, so you're saying, hey, these systems, especially when, you know, let's make it super concrete, right? Like, distributing Wikipedia in Turkey, like straight up illegal. This becomes a really hard values question. So the way that we kind of take this perspective in the IPFS project on the Protocol Labs is that we think it's really important, two things are important. One is making sure that we have good tools and aim for good futures. Meaning, and there's a lot enveloped in what kind of good means. We would think that a very repressive government that says you can't read Wikipedia is probably bad. It's probably not a good thing. But we're also very cognizant of the fact that if you enable distribution of information, that can be really harmful, and harmful well beyond kind of copyright infringement. It could be harmful in terms of like terrorist attacks, and it could be harmful in terms of all kinds of like, you know, bad things. You know, the good rebels of today are like the bad rebels of the future, right? And so the way to think about it in terms of kind of the good bad problem though is that there really is this hard tension between computing systems that enforce autocratic or like total, you know, imagine kind of like a digital totalitarian state emerging today. So imagine like you transport yourself back into like 1940 or 1935, and imagine like the totalitarian states of that day having the power that the computing systems of today afford. Like that's a really scary thing, right? So imagine like the mass surveillance is happening through all of these cameras everywhere and through all of these social systems aren't just like mass surveillance from like the US NSA, but like are suddenly like mass surveillance from people that are actually like trying to commit genocide. Like that's a whole scale of thing, like it's kind of crazy. And if we're not careful, we're like sailing right into that. So that's what one of our positions is that the computing systems that we have today are actually quite dangerous, and they're building, as a whole, we're kind of building systems that, or society's building systems that are closer to digital totalitarian dictatorship possibilities. And so the flip side is between like that and then having systems that are cryptographically secure that give you freedom of speech. And, you know, and freedom of speech is a very, you know, kind of problematic thing. It's very good, but also very problematic. And systems that give you freedom of association, meaning like the ability to interact with other people, is a really important freedom that you know, kind of like the Western liberal democracy said, hey, like that's a good thing. But is that really the case in the digital systems when that might mean all kinds of bad things that happen? That's a question that we're probably going to have to contend with over the next few decades. And so this is a kind of hard line to draw. The way that we take it in terms of the project, you know, because you know you're really choosing between two bad states, and what we think is like it's probably less bad to have groups being able to do bad things, but not accidentally lock in a government that like is extremely repressive and that you know has like 1984 levels of control. And so we kind of angle in that direction. From a project perspective, we build tools that anybody. Communities can decide how to interact and what to block. So a community could decide to block information and say, hey, we don't want to distribute this content as a community. And so at that point, like you would make your own deployment or make your own, use the same tooling. or individually self-select out of distributing some material. So for example, in the Wikipedia case, you don't have to distribute anything unless you explicitly like choose to do so. That's a kind of like an important choice moment there. Yeah, it's hard stuff though. Yep.
We're running quite late, so I'm wondering maybe we take one more question and then head downstairs. But we have time to ask more questions down the first floor bistro. So it's last question.
Yeah. So do you think that sometime toward the end of Web 3.0, for example, academic publishing could become better credited, like have better credit attribution?
Yeah. So we hope that the tooling. And by the way, this quote from Minsky is about machine learning. And this is a quote about neural networks. And so Minsky's talking about like the very tricky problem of in a neural network assigning, doing kind of forward propagation, feed forward and back prop. But that's exactly credit attribution, right? Like it's a very interesting like parallel here. So we hope that the tools that we and other people are building now can be helpful in that direction. There are already people experimenting with SourceGrid looking at citation graphs. And so that's all of that is like very ripe for hacking on that kind of stuff. Protocol Labs itself wants to kind of like a, you know, beyond computing or like hard deep Web3 things, we're very interested in kind of like meta science, meaning like how do we, like the science of doing science, meaning like what are the kind of filters that are in place? What are the mechanisms that are there that work or don't work? And so we're interested in like pushing work that shows what kinds of things work or don't work, and what kind of models might be better. So doing work around doing this for credit attribution in science is like something that we would be very much like in directly like actually working on, just opportunity cost right now. There are people working on it, and you should probably either expect this to happen in the next few years, or like join us on GitHub and do it.
Okay, well, before we thank Juan one more time, let me just remind you, on First Floor Bistro, there's some drinks and snacks waiting for us. We can ask more questions.
Great, thank you.